people in the world.
What's the name of the organization?
La Via Campesina.
Family Farm.
Family Farm. So there's information up here which I brought, so feel free to grab and use it if you want. And we've been around about 20 years, 20 plus years. I mean, we're not as big as like Farmers Union, but you know, we work with Farmers Union when we can. We're about the Farm Bureau, so our Jamie's, but we have members, actually members of Farm Bureau too. So that's just a little bit of background on the group. And just to share, well, for interest and full disclosure, I do teach at Madison College. So if I start getting, you know, talking more about economics and stuff, that's what I teach. I also teach environmental studies, so a lot of stuff that lectures, you know, right, that's the type of stuff I teach in my classes, all the time to students. And my father, my grandfather actually worked for Monsanto. So he is one of those people, he came back from World War II, you know, fought in North Africa. He was a Monsanto employee. He was actually one of the people who helped convert chemical weapons into pesticides over the days. That was part of his actual job. So that whole origin of pesticides is really important for people to realize. I really recommend this book. If you haven't seen it, it's all about the history of pesticides. And has some, you know, shocking pictures and ads from way back when, you know, DDT is good for me. Some of you might be old enough to remember those. Remember those types of ads.
Can you hold it up, Brian? Can you hold it up, the book?
Yeah, it's called War on Bugs. Excellent book. I really recommend it, from the history of pesticides and how they're being used. And the sad thing is that we went through this whole Rachel Carson moment, right, where we suddenly realize, you know, pesticides are bad. Rachel Carson writes this book. She's, you know, vilified by the chemical industry, called crazy. You probably all know the whole story. In fact, I think a new documentary just came out about her life, right, recently. But, you know, that whole experience that we had here, sort of educating ourselves about the impact of chemicals and maybe stopping something like DDT, we did finally ban at one point. That, this whole process of promoting pesticides is still happening elsewhere in the world. So, like, we literally export.
Oh, yeah.
These technologies, export these models. And so that's really important to realize, you know, not, but you know, our group would argue that we tend to do field testing on our own people first. So we're the guinea pigs first, and then like, oh, okay, now these guinea pigs got smart. Now we're relocating overseas. So we're gonna start seeing this technology in Brazil or South Africa or wherever, as part of the Green Revolution, now the Gene Revolution, which, you know, partly came out of this Lane Grant College here. And I met, when Norman Borlaug was alive, I met him. I had a big argument with him. The FAO consultant we had here with the United Nations, he was there. We were like debating with him, our family farmers we had bought, saying, this is not a technology we want. And why are you promoting this? So so just to add a few things to what Lex shared. Farmers, okay, first of all, farmers often are forced to adopt these technologies. Okay, they're not... I mean, sometimes they buy into the whole, you know, technology will fix all the problems, but a lot of them are forced to buy these technologies. They literally are told by a bank, you will not get a loan unless you adopt genetically engineered crops in your fields, and that becomes part of a technology package, right? So you cannot just buy seeds anymore. You rent the seeds. Do you understand this concept? Because once they're patented, you don't own them. So a lot of farmers, and we have members of our group who have planted GMO seeds, because they got contaminated. They were sued by Monsanto for patent infringement. They're forced to plant these seeds now. These seeds will not grow without Roundup, so they're forced to buy Roundup, and they're like holding their nose every day planting those fields of Roundup soybeans. They have no choice anymore. If they want to do soybeans, that's what they're stuck doing on their land. It's contaminated, and they're stuck in this cycle. Okay, and these are members of our own group who hate the technology, but are forced to use it basically now. So this is something to be aware of. You have to buy the seeds, pesticides, fertilizers, machines. It's all part of a package. Farmers get sick from this stuff all the time too. The founding president of our group was in the UW hospital after storing some pesticides in his hand. He went to the hospital immediately. Toxic shock exposure, right? Normal. The doctors didn't know initially what was wrong with him. And they finally figured, oh, you're a farmer. Oh my gosh, you put your hands in the pesticide. That's what happened to you. So, you know, so farmers themselves are very aware. I mean, why are the dead fish floating by the river? You know, what happened? Was there a pesticide episode runoff? Why is my well water contaminated? And, you know, Lex mentioned some of the studies, but, I mean, Warren Porter, I really recommend looking at some of his work. He's a toxicologist at UW-Madison. And he's written all sorts of studies. I mean, he was here for the pollinator conference a couple months ago. But he's literally done studies where if you look at the time of year, January, February, March, when do they apply all these chemicals? April, Right in here, April, May, June, they're told not to spray after June 1st or July 1st. Steve, what COVID's, don't soak your system now. But you can look at, you know, pesticide levels in water. He's done these studies, right? In groundwater, people drinking, it's going to be a huge spike, like this, from the application, right? Children conceive during these months, guess what? Higher problems. This is the type of studies he's working on. If you were conceived during this time frame in rural America, an area where they use lots of pesticides, like atrazine, Roundup, and then you track those children born 9 months later, they're going to have a lot more health problems. And this is the type of work he's doing, trying to figure this out, right? But this is the type of stuff we, you know, we need to get this information, you know, this information out there, right? That's part of what we're trying to do here. And as Lex mentioned, we have weed resistance, so Roundup doesn't kill your weeds anymore. You're a farmer, what do? Oh, I need to buy the 2,4-D now, Agent Orange. Remix. So to try to kill the Roundup, it's sort of like, I always compare it to like the nursery rhyme I grew up with, like I swallowed the spider to catch the fly. You're like stuck having to keep getting more stuff to kill the weeds that are not resistant to the previous stuff. And don't even get me started on how bad 2,4-D is. You have a whole faction of them. It's like going backwards in time, you know, as far as pesticide exposure. And we have a lot of veterans who are farmers who are exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam. And now they're going to be exposed again. You know, that should not be happening, right? That's, they're talking about another vulnerable population, right? So we have, you know, and then we have, you know, farm workers. We talked to, I mean, I've been, if you travel overseas, you can see this, right? I've been to banana plantations in Costa Rica where all the men are sterile. They're all sterile. They can't have any children anymore. Because they're using the nematicides in the banana plantations to try to keep pesticides, pests down, and they're all sterilized. So that's the end of that, you know, as far as having a family there. You're not going to have much of a family, right? We talked about, you know, declining sperm counts. It's one thing Warren Porter will talk all about. Why are sperm counts dropping? Why are less than 20% of men in the United States able to be sperm donors anymore? What's going on there? Is that due to pesticide exposure? You would argue yes, probably partly due to pesticide exposure. Right? Increase in prostate, breast, ovarian cancer. Is it any coincidence that Syngenta, the maker of all these wonderful chemicals, is also one of the biggest sellers of breast cancer drugs?
No, it's no surprise.
Probably no surprise. Okay, so this is something to be aware of. Like, these chemical companies are in the chemical business. They're not interested in preventing problems.
They're in the profit business.
They're interested in solving your problem that they have maybe helped create, and that's how they make money. And we can talk about the land grant colleges doing the same thing in some ways, right? I went to UW-Madison, another big land grant college. Farmers always joke, land grant college does not study anything that saves us money. Think about that. The land grant college does not study anything that saves us money. So how many integrated pest management classes do they teach at UW-Madison? A few. I've taken them. I took every one I could when I was in grad school there. But there's very few of them. I was in a class where I literally had to play a potato game, and we'll have Amy talk about this. I had to play a computer potato game in my agronomy class, right? Save the potatoes. We have the option, spray. Spray, I'm going, no, I'm not going to be into the organic potato farmer, I'm not going to do it. But you literally had to push the spray button every time it came up in the computer program to win. There's no way you can win the game without spraying on schedule. And that's what they teach the potato farmers too. That's what they teach them. Spray on schedule. To win the game, you must spray on schedule.
Well, even if you did this integrated pest management, you're forced to buy, as you said, by the banks and
the
threat of lawsuit, right?
Well, you may still, I mean, you can only do it if you're not already contaminated, I suppose.
Or that in contamination the
drift. Yeah, this drift is everywhere. Yeah, right, drift is everywhere. So, and then people, we often are told, you know, farmers are told, well, you know, this is going to say, we heard about it, it's going to reduce pesticide use. That's not true. We all, the studies have shown this, it actually increases pesticide use. They will argue, we invented no-till agriculture.
No-till
agriculture. We don't have to. We want to prevent soil erosion. We're destroying the Mississippi River, you know, the Gulf, the dead zone in the Gulf. The only way to save that is not till the ground and spray chemicals. That will dump the ground covered, right? No-till agriculture. I go, excuse me, but the original no-till agriculture was organic.
You don't till.
Well, you don't have to till. Anyways, but they have this whole sort of, you know, the world started with more, you know, idea of the Green Revolution is the only way to feed the world. Yeah, so, and then just to remind people that the organic, you know, organic as an alternative to this model, right, is being challenged constantly. People probably remember, and I was one of those people who wrote all those comments to the FDA way back when, USDA, when they were creating the organic standards, right? People remember they wanted GMOs to be organic when they first proposed the rule. Not by surprise. Along with sewage sludge and irrigation, they had all these great technologies to make it organic. And people said, no way, it's not organic. And they probably knew it because we know the main reason for genetic engineering is not to improve quality of the crops or nutrition, and it's to become resistant to pesticides. That's a dominant trait for all this engineering. So they're trying to weaken the organic standards again, right? They're trying to pretend BT corn is still organic. There are all these efforts to try to weaken organic standards, right? So we need to be very diligent about that. And as Lex mentioned, we have no real precautionary principle when it comes to technology approval in this country. I mean, the World Health Organization just, you know, declared glyphosate, Roundup, to be a carcinogen, right? So all these, you know, California is now responding by trying to phase out use of Roundup. You know, but the according to the U.S. government, it's A-okay. You know, atrazine's wonderful from the EPA. Just keep using it. All these other countries in Europe have banned atrazine long ago. Syngenta's based in a country that can't even use its own chemical. It's selling it to us, right? We're still spraying it. And then the idea of like these synergistic effects, I mean, you're not just talking atrazine, you're talking all sorts of chemicals, right? Roundup, atrazine, cocktail of chemicals, right? And you know, it's not just killing you. That's the other thing that always shocks me. Like, well, there's no dead fish. I'm going, but the fish all have chemicals in them. The fish may not have actually outright died, but now they're bioaccumulating all these chemicals, which you eat that. I mean, why do we have all these fish advisories? So there's all these indicators that there's some problem. I mean, the wild ducks living in the Fox Valley of Wisconsin are more toxic than domestic chicken coming out of Golden Plum. I mean, they're just chock full of chemicals. And they're living in the wild, so you want to go eat some wild duck and enjoy it, you know, but it's not going to be really healthy for you, probably. You know, you go to Isle Royale National Park, which I've been to many times. Those fish in the middle of Isle Royale National Park are full of chemicals. DDT, atrazine, how did it get there? It's all coming in the rain clouds, dropping into the lakes. I was there when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was doing a fish survey on Isle Royale. I was talking to someone who said, yeah, we just pulled this fish out. This thing's full of chemicals. And going, wow. The middle of Isle Royale National Park.
Where is it?
Yeah, Lake Superior. It's the most least visited national park in the U.S. You have to get there by boat. But you think, oh, this is a remote, beautiful location. Toxic. You know, I worked in Zimbabwe. All the women's breast milk there is full of DDT. From decades of spraying to control malaria or whatever. So I mean, it's a huge. So farmers are very aware of this, and I want to feel. I really want to echo Lex's point about like. I mean, right now it seems to be really sexy and cool to like rush out into rural areas and want to work with farmers. You know, like we need to figure out the Trump voters. I mean, there's all these people right now rushing to do this, getting money to do this. And believe it or not, there are a lot of people living in these areas already. They've been organizing for centuries, decades, right? they've been doing things there. They have coalitions built. They are not dumb farmers. I get this argument all the time. Like, oh, we're going to go teach those farmers how to farm better. I go, excuse me, but where were you when rotational grazing started? Did you start the organic movement? It wasn't you, Mr. Extension Agent from the NASA or whatever. Or you, Monsanto, it was somebody else. You know, in fact, probably it was a farmer. It was just learning from maybe Native Americans everybody next to you about how to plant corn and squash and beans or rotate crops. Or, you know, oats, sweet peas, and barley grow. And that nursery rhyme teaches you about farming. It came over their immigrant ancestors, right? That's smart things to say. We really need to valorize, you know, I grew up on a farm, so I mean, I take this personally, being called a country pumpkin, a stupid redneck. I mean, I get these labels all the time, in Madison, Wisconsin, by the way, a progressive town. After a while, it gets very tiresome. So, you know, we all want to, we have more prisoners than farmers in the United States. Farmers are not going to win this fight on their own. they need to ally with other people, including farm workers, other rural people, but then also their urban allies, right? Maybe it's a faith community, maybe it's all of us are eaters, right? Presumably we're eating still. So they need to work with environmentalists, other people, need to work together in coalition to change these systems. And you know, we can educate people till the cows come home, but part of it is moving knowledge to action. Right? How do you motivate people to actually do something? Which is what, the work that Amy's doing with Toxic Taters is like a great example of building those coalitions, getting people organized, and they're up against the most powerful potato company in the world, pretty much. You'll hear the story. And to see how that actually works as a organizing strategy. And the people involved, we want to talk about brilliant people, and we have some brilliant organizers out there in rural areas who've been doing this for a long time. They may have not gone to college, may not have a fancy degree, but they really know how to organize, and they have amazing knowledge, information, often based upon personal experience, and knowing their land, and knowing what's supposed to be, why are there no butterflies here? What happened to them? Where are my bees? That should inform our work, and often we can be our own best resources if we tap into that and don't dismiss these people and recognize them for what they have to share. So I think I have one more question. I want to make sure that we have time for maybe to talk in the discussion.
Yeah, I'm from Iowa, and we have a fairly active Iowa Farmers Union group there, and you mentioned that you work with them where you can. I brought up the Food Sovereignty Prize to them once, and everybody just freaked. So can you tell me how you work with them and what advice you've got to
them? Okay, well, food sovereignty, for those who don't understand that concept, I would invite you to go to the Family Farm Defenders table in the other hall. We have information on food sovereignty there. So food sovereignty, the way I describe it for this audience, and this is a concept that came from the Global South to the North, which is why a lot of groups in the North are resistant to it, to be honest, because they don't like ideas of other countries telling us how we should be behaving for ourselves and the rest of the world. But the idea behind food sovereignty is sort of re-democratizing, re-localizing our food system.
What is that? I couldn't hear you.
Food sovereignty.
Is what?
Re-democratizing, re-localizing your food system. So it's very different from food
security. So the local, you buy local?
Well, more than that. So it's different than food security. We can get into this concept later. Food security is a term that Henry Kissinger coined at an FAO conference in the context of the Cold War. Okay, so you can see where the security angle is coming from. Yeah. We will provide food to our people. We will use food as a weapon if need be. Those are all violations of food sovereignty, by the way. Those are not acceptable concepts of food sovereignty. Food is not a weapon. Farmers have the right to feed their own people first, which is totally anti-WTO. I'll tell you right now, that's not, WTO says food sovereignty must be banned, period. You'll be forced to import food.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so that's why the food sovereignty concept, even for farmers union people, can be difficult, because they think they should have access to Japan. I should be able to dump my crops in those countries if I want to. I don't think that's fair. But we can talk more about that. So we have one more. I want to make sure Amy gets a chance.
So
sure.
I just had a thought, and I just want to know if I'm thinking along the right line. So it seemed like the way that pesticides work is they attack the nervous system, the reproductive system, or the digestive system of the target critter. And they will do the same thing to you. They will attack your nervous system, your digestive system, and your reproductive system.
Right. Yeah, that's why BT is very scary to me. Okay, so BT, we think, we have natural BT, we just spray, topical application, we'll kill caterpillars. Dissolves naturally, but the synthetic version of BT that's been bioengineered to put into corn and so on does not biodegrade the same way. There's actually 16 versions of it now, all different types of BT. There's have synergistic effects, not biodegrade. So you literally have BT washing off cornfields into streams, killing non-target species in the water, persistent in the soil, and then you eat high fructose corn syrup in your junk food diet, and they've done these studies in Canada, not being done in the US, does that BT dissolve in your gut? That's what they all say. Yes, it's gonna totally dissolve, but no, it doesn't. It crosses your gut membrane into you and does what happens to honeybees to you on a human scale. So, this is the type of research that people are doing, which is very disturbing, but why don't we look at high fructose corn syrup as a source of human health problems? If it's concentrated BT, toxin basically, from GE to corn, which is what it is, then that's going to be a challenge, right? So, okay, I want, okay.
I just have one comment.
We need to wrap up.
I said.
Yeah, maybe we can share some more questions. I'll let Amy share the toxic tank story. This is more positive.
I wanted to do a hot topic.
All right, hi. My name's Amy. I work for Toxic Taters. Yes, which I will explain. But before I explain who Toxic Taters is, I have a question for the group that I want to understand a little bit more about who's in here. And I just want to ask, how many folks either currently live or have lived a significant portion of their life in a rural area? Okay. Cool. That gives me a better sense of who's here. My next question for you is, how many of you are familiar with the name Ronald Donald Offit? Ronald Donald Offit.
Sounds familiar, but...
Okay, or R.D. Offit. Okay, it's a name that I got familiar with a couple of years ago, and a name that I have grown to really dislike. He's also known as RDO. RDO is the largest potato grower in the U.S. And one of the largest in the world, probably the largest in the world. And that is where Toxic Taters comes from, is known as the folks who are fighting RDO. And we are based in, we are in Minnesota, and we're based in Callaway, which is on the White Earth Indian Reservation. And we are a native and non-native group, which is kind of exciting in northern Minnesota, because native folks and non-native folks don't really play together in northern Minnesota. Those of you who are from the Midwest, I think probably have a pretty good understanding of that, that there's a long history of native folks and non-native folks living alongside of each other and not talking to each other, and a deep history of racism, and a lack of understanding of treaty rights, and how those things operate. And so the fact that Toxic Taters has been fairly successful in being able to work as a non-native and non-native group is very, very exciting. And an ongoing challenge for us to figure out, how do we get to talk to each other? How do we get to understand each other? How do we get to work together? And how do we use the fact that we're both native and non-native to be able to battle this huge corporate giant? Toxic Taters started as an organization around 2014. We actually started as a group before that. Some of our folks have been battling RDO since way back in the 90s or even before that. But around 2006, two different groups, the Minnesotans for Pesticide Awareness and White Earth Pesticide Action Network, both were working on the issue and both realized that they needed some help. So they called Pesticide Action Network and said, hey, this is bigger than what we can handle. We need you guys. Can you come out here and help us? And PAN came on out. They sent some organizers and scientists out to help start a drift catching project. So folks in northern Minnesota started doing air monitoring, started looking at what was happening around the fields, because we were started by folks who were living right next to the fields. We were not started by environmentalists. The folks who started our organization did not want to start an organization. They did not want to be battling a potato giant. That was not their deal. They wanted to just live their lives, but they got sick of getting sick. And they got sick of losing livestock, they got sick of losing their own crops, and they had no other choice. They had to do something about it. They started working with PAN, started doing air monitoring, started finding chemicals in the air, generally about a mile away from the field, sometimes up to about 10 miles away from the fields. And they put together a report that they began to share publicly, began to share with legislators, began to share with other leaders, and started organizing. And by about 2014, they became what was at that point called the Toxic Taters Coalition. Now we simply talk about it as Toxic Taters because the groups that formed it became one organization. We started out as a pretty small group. We're still fairly small, but we now have meetings happening in a number of different areas. In Pine Point, which is on the White Earth Indian Reservation, in Park Rapids, which is where the RDO plant is, and in Wadena, which is one of the counties that's particularly impacted by the fields and has really high cancer rates and a lot of other illnesses. Give you a little more history about where RDO is coming from in Minnesota. They started around Pine Point on the reservation and around Osage, which is just off the reservation, in the mid-1960s. And at that point, they were planting potatoes every year. And by the 1980s, they couldn't do that anymore. They had just completely destroyed the ecosystem. And they started to have to move to using some best management practices and going to a three-year rotation. And continuing to expand and needing to expand more because, well, they couldn't plant less potatoes, so they needed more fields. And now, I believe they're somewhere, they are around 20,000 acres, I think. There's 40 to 50,000 acres of potatoes planted in Minnesota annually. So we're talking about a pretty huge crop. And one of the things with potatoes versus some of the other crops that are using pesticides is that potatoes use pesticides about every 5 to 10 days.
Five to 10 days.
Yeah, what happens with potatoes is that they're using the pesticides every 5 to 10 days, and then at the end of the season, they kill off all the vines, and they fumigate the soil, and then after they've harvested the potatoes, they give them a chemical bath so that they don't sprout. So you're talking about some really massive amounts of chemicals there. You're also talking about a massive amount of water being used, because, you know, we can't have little shrivelly kind of bumpy potatoes for our french fries. So we want to have the big, nice, white, perfect fries. So RDO alone uses about 13 billion gallons of water in Minnesota. So we have some huge impacts there, both with the chemicals and the amount of water being used. And most of RDO's potatoes that they're growing here in Minnesota are being used for frozen potato products. I'm guessing that we don't have anybody in this room who eats a whole lot of McDonald's french fries.
I can't.
And people go, no, no.
But they serve them in the mushroom. Every meal they serve them in the mushroom.
God knows what they're serving in the lunchroom.
So those fries that you're getting in the lunchroom, if you're eating those fries, those fries probably have the residue of about 24 different pesticides on them. And that, one of the questions that I get from a lot of people, you know, is what do I do to get the residue off those fries? You don't. You just don't. Yeah, those don't wash off. That's simply the reality. From commercially grown potatoes, you know, that are not organic, for the fresh potatoes, you're getting about 35 different pesticides, which also are not going to wash off. So that's one of the messages that we're constantly giving to folks, because a lot of folks around us don't know what's happening to those potatoes. So it's one of those things that if you're choosing what you're going to eat organic, potatoes is one of the things you want to choose to eat organic. Yeah.
Just as an aside, I come from California, and the strawberries that you all eat for the rest of the country, they're not organic, they have that same kind of residue.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
We can't
strawberries,
eat that.
Blueberries,
but I do still
apples,
eat them once.
No. Oranges now. It's really sad.
Yeah, there's a lot of scary stuff out there. But that gives you a little bit of a picture of what we are dealing with, what kind of things are happening. In the area where we're at, RDO is a major employer. And one of the challenges that we've had as Toxictators is just going up against that fact that it is a major employer in an area in which we have a lot of folks who are very low income. On parts of the reservation, over a quarter of the folks are unemployed. So when we are going out there and talking to folks about what's going on with RDO, it's been very important to us to not go out and say, you know, we want to get rid of RDO. We have to be going out there and talking about, we want RDO to change how they're growing their potatoes. And that kind of messaging really seems to work well, because a lot of those folks also have family or friends who either currently work at the plant or have worked at the plant in the past. and have gotten sick. So those kind of messages, connecting with folks. I think one of the things that Lex was kind of mentioning and John was mentioning about organizing with rural folks and the whole Trump piece, and that really caught me. A lot of the folks who work with Toxictators are Trump voters. And that kind of surprises a lot of people.
Really?
You serious?
Is any party speaking?
They didn't get misguided at all. What the reality is that they have recognized that for years that liberal folks have come out every time there's an election and come out and said, hey, we're going to help you. We're going to make things all better. And let's make it happen. And they've come out for that election, and then they've left again. And they have completely gotten screwed over every 2 to 4 years. And so they said, you know, I'm done with this. We got to do something else. And they said, wow, there's something else here. Maybe we can try this thing instead. Yeah, and I think that's an essential piece to all of our organizing, is to recognize that those folks out there are sick of people coming out every 2 to 4 years and saying, hey, we'll fix it for you. Yeah, because they know that it's not going to happen that way. It has never happened that way. And as I said, a lot of our folks with Toxictators have been organizing around this issue, you know, since the 90s. Yeah, they don't need somebody new to come in and say, here, we're going to fix it. You know, they know the issue. They know the area. They know what's going on. They need somebody to come in and say, what's going on here? How can we be helpful? How can we listen to you and understand what's happening here? And what can we do to work alongside you? And how can we do this for the long term? The other thing I wanted to do a little bit today is to share some of those stories directly from some of the folks that we have here. And I wanted to share one from Evelyn Bellinger. She lives in Pine Point. She's a native elder. And I just, I was hoping she was going to be able to join us today, but she had some other commitments. So I just want to share this piece that she had written for us called Water is a Necessity for Survival. And then after that, Lex, I'll share the video. I was raised and have lived, oh goodness, I might not share this because it looks like there's some pieces cut off here. I was raised and have lived in it lived at my present address all of my life, 64 years, except for a number of years that I worked in Minneapolis, in which I returned home to visit. Returned home most weekends to visit. I moved back permanently in May of 2000. That summer, plus a year, I stayed on with my sister in the east end of the village, a half a mile from here. That was when and where I noticed how close the RDO helicopters came and flew within 500 feet of her house. At that time, I did take a picture. That's been 16 years ago today, and I can still go to the outside in the spring and summer months and around 6:30 in the mornings, and I can hear them loading up and flying on the north end or wherever they are. And I can hear them on the west side later in the afternoons flying. At times they have been spraying on different days and sometimes every other day. And it seems like when it is calm out and no wind blowing, you can smell the chemicals in the air. We are surrounded on the north, east, and west sides of the village with fields that they spray with helicopters. They all have water irrigation systems set up, and we have three lakes that are within a half to 1 mile of the fields and are the same distance from the village, and those have creeks or riverbeds that run through the village going south. One creek runs through the western part of the village, one runs through the center of the village, which is starting to flow more east along the main road through the village due to beaver dams. The owner of the land on the south side of the boundary line of the reservation does not allow anyone to trespass, and the beavers keep building up the dams. I have noticed that these trees that were planted behind my sister's house, the farmer that owned it quit planting it on a regular basis, and he planted many trees. The trees by her house are a lot bigger than the ones that were planted at the same time in the southwest end of that field. There are many children playing in that riverbed on the west side, and they are constantly playing outside all summer in the village. I have since developed asthma, as well I know my grandniece has, and I don't know how many others have. There have been a couple of babies born in this area that have issues with development, such as lack of brain mass. We have had many members of this community develop cancer, and some who have passed on. Some of these are members of the younger generation in their early 30s. We have about 300 members that live here, and every one of them is related to someone who has had cancer or knows someone that did or does. I have found a couple of dead hawks in my yard. I remember I used to see tons of rabbit tracks around the house. I don't see those anymore. This past summer, I collected rainwater for my plants, and I have noticed that the water has turned a pinkish color when it settled. I collected it from the runoff on my roof. I do not drink my tap water, although I use it for cooking because it is boiled. I have studied American Indian history, White Earth history, and our Pine Point history. Our ancestors depended on these lakes for fishing and our water for survival, and we still do. In the document of the Winters document, Doctrine, it is clearly stated and acknowledged that water is a necessity for survival. Also, we retain the rights to hunt fish in the treaties. With these chemicals in this area, the contamination of our waters is violating these rights along with the health of our people. These are my concerns and experience, by Evelyn Bellinger. And those are kind of typical stories. You hear a lot of things of people with cancer, a lot of things of people with asthma, with people with neurological disorders, babies being born without parts of their brains, of all the developmental disorders. And one of the pieces that actually really strikes me in that story, and I've talked with Evelyn about this, and hopefully she's not doing it anymore, is that she still cooks with that water. Because one of the issues that we see a lot of is the nitrate concentrations. So when you cook with that water, you're boiling off the water and you're leaving the chemicals in there. So there's just a lot of issues like that. And I just wanted to share it with you a piece that we've done on McDonald's video, just a very short piece, and a little opportunity to hear some more from some of our local folks.
We started out in 1977 building up our flock of sheep. Potato farmers moved in. They started spraying on us right next to the sheep.
We put the pesticide drift catcher right underneath the air intake in the new Pine Point School. Sure enough, we were getting hits of chlorothalonil.
One by one, they started to die. We lost 29 head. Their livers were tan instead of the dark red, which means they were poisoned.
Behavioral problems, aggression, all these things are part of, you know, what goes hand in hand with these types of chemicals.
We have RDO, a major corporation who has a lot of power in this area, where they don't deserve to have that power. The people who deserve to have the power are the ones who live here, the ones who are breathing and drinking and living in this area.
Well, it's not just for us, but the future generations down the road. I mean, they might have nothing here, you know.
Opportunities to be engaged in what we're doing. First of all, I'm going to hand around our petition to McDonald's. We are pushing them to cut their use of pesticides. McDonald's is one of RDO's biggest buyers. And as I said, RDO is the biggest potato grower in the country. If we can get McDonald's to change what they're doing, we get RDO to change what they are doing, we've changed the entire potato industry. The second thing that I'm going to ask you to do is right now, Toxic Taters is attempting to get a meeting with McDonald's, and we are calling on organizations to sign on to this letter. We'd like to get all of our sign-ons by August 15th. So I'm giving you a letter to take a look at and see if your organizations can sign on. Lex, can you put up my email address up there? Awesome.
I mean, I don't know why not.
And so Lex is putting up my email address where you can talk to me after this and let us know if you can sign on. The other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to let you all have a sticker. And so you can wear your stickers today and tell folks about what you heard today and talked about today. Yeah.
What year was the agreement signed with McDonald's?
2009.
And so what's your analysis about what's happened and what hasn't happened between then and now? And how is that different from what you're doing now?
We have had some successes with RDO. McDonald's has done a good job of not talking to us. But RDO has started to move towards using more cover crops. They've started to use more computer technology to target how they're doing their spraying. They're starting to move towards more sustainability, but they have a really long way to go. And one of the big challenges that we've had with them is that they're willing to give us very broad definitions of what they're doing, but they're not willing to give us much of the data of how it's working or where exactly they're doing all of it. So there's still
a
lot.
So just a little follow-up. So is that giving McDonald's an excuse of not acting, like they're saying, oh, there's progress, so we're good?
Yeah, that is, and when they have communicated with us, they've kind of been telling us, oh, you just need to talk to RDO, figure it out with RDO.
Amy, have you thought about some legal recourse against RDO and McDonald's? Do you have enough evidence to do that? Or
I think we probably would have the evidence to do that. We've chosen not to take that route yet. We've really focused on the community organizing piece of it.
But is that an option you want to pursue something?
I think we would really have to talk with Pan about that and figure out if it would make sense for both of our organizations. But it might be a good thing if we do that to talk with you about it, because I know that you have a lot of experience in that area.
I lost a lot of money, money well spent.
Yeah. And I can just add that we're involved right now with a lawsuit against Enlist Duo, which is a new 2,4-D crop. So that's both the target of the federal government, saying we should not have approved this. There are lawsuits all the time going on about these things. Some are against government, one's against private industry, and there'll be more technology. So love to drag you to court and you come out.
Hi, I'm Sue Peters. I'm a member of the American Monetary Institute. We're a sponsor. And I was very curious when you said, John, that the banks won't give a loan to farmers unless they have GMOs.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things I heard.
I don't know what percentage of the loans are like that, mm-hmm. but I just want to say that I do research with our privately run banking system, which is the creator of our money. People don't know that, but they control our money. And if you take this company, which is a public company, right? Mm-hmm.
RDO, no.
It's private?
Well, Monsanto.
They were public for a number of years, but they've gone back to being private.
It's like Cargill. You can't go to their shareholder meeting.
Oh, well, maybe they do. When they were public, they would have their SEC balance sheets. And to go into the balance sheet and see what percentage of their net worth is debt that they own multinational banks, because that's these corporations in our country they're being funded every day by hundreds of millions of dollars of loans from the banks. So that's another area of attack, is the banks, to cut their source of power.
Can I chime in with, I'm also part of the American Monetary Institute, and I've been looking at these problems for years, and a lot of the problems that you were mentioning, you know, all the way from people not being able to afford organic food, to the shriveling up of rural communities, and the you know, the fact that they're really being decimated all over the place, the fact that you can try lawsuits and all this, but you're really fucking the money power. And you need to get money back into the communities.
Yeah.
And the way to do that is to through the proper monetary reform. And that's what we're about. So that's an important element in all of this.
I'm 40 now, Ohad. And about 2 months ago, my daughter was pregnant, 8 months. By force and free, they were trying to pesticide our
My name is Hindalo, originally from Sierra Leone. I just want to share a little bit about our story, what we are working on, and how all of this relates to the more broader picture of we are the global south, what we are receiving, and how all of this have an impact on us, you know, living on a farm, growing on a farm. So I'm starting the first village preschool program in Sierra Leone, and I'm deliberately using permaculture ecology as the center of our curriculum instruction and support system. Well, Sierra Leone has gone through war, but after the war, we had a lot of mining companies that came into the country, really for extractive industry-related issues. And chemicals were heavily used for extraction of, you know, 34 precious minerals, gold, diamonds, and what have you. That, you know, that gave me the insight into what the use of chemicals, you know, and the impact of all of that. And so the issue of food, the issue of food sovereignty we are talking about, the issue of you know, lack of community participation for their own food needs and what have you, that became really a big issue. And so one of the things that we started noticing was the lack of, for instance, I went home 1 year and I was told that this year the pepper did not do very well. The okra did not produce a lot of yield. I was like, what's the problem? Well, we had, you know, the USDA department that was there. We had Monsanto that was there. We even had Starbucks that comes into the country to look at coffee, you know, tea plantation and all those kinds of things. And all of the impact of, you know, just having chemicals being given to the farmers through loans, through the loans.
Forced on them.
Forced on them through the loans. And, you know, and then at the end of the day, they have to repay these loans, you know, by selling produce, production that was coming very low, onions and what have you, you know, carrots and all the kinds of things. So pesticides became a very big national conversation. What do we do? So some of us went back and we said, okay, well, we need to go back into, you know, a concept that we have developed, reclaiming the land. How do you reclaim the land? How do you go about engaging communities as well? You cannot go wrong with children. You cannot go wrong with food. So you focus on those two directions. You try to engage them and do what needs to be done. That is the direction we've been going. So we've set up a huge village preschool program to say, if you want to bring in pesticides, you want to bring in extractive industry, you have to move people from their land. You know, get rid of them, that is going to be a whole challenge. Especially when back in the 70s, you had communities where we had this farming system, slash and burn method. You have to move and allow the land to lay fallow for several years. Well, population has boomed, people are coming in, you know, the Chinese are showing up all over the place. So How do you deal with all of those kinds of things? We are looking at a permaculture support system to go back into reclaiming the land and organizing communities to be part of what we are doing. So that's just our own story from the Global
South. Very nice. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm a local organic farmer, and I wanted to, nobody really pushed the idea that when you kill insects, you literally kill everything else as well. Humans, but also the entire biome, anything else living in that area.
Bacteria.
And so then it all, I mean, the whole thing becomes dead eventually. The other side of it is that if you can try to bring things back, the kind of thing that he's doing, in, which we also are trying to do here, is that once you bring insects back and you have like 40 kinds of insects, then they balance themselves.
Yep.
They manage the situation. Too many, oh, we got Japanese beetles. Hey, we got guys that eat those.
Well,
it's
because of monoculture.
Well, that's a big point. The main reason for the GMO is the idea that we're going to increase yield. Well, actually, that often there's a yield drag. So you actually get lower yields,
yeah.
Especially if you don't use the proper chemicals. And then, like you said, if you just like reserve part of your cropland for natural predators, you might actually get higher yields.
Yeah.
By just saving a buffer strip with native plants, you have all this healthy insect populations controlling the pests. Instant increase in yields.
Well, you can eat the insects, too.
That's true, too.
It looks like we are already running a little over. And to, in also, in response to your question, though, I want to say that Toxictators is doing an organic potato farm tour on Saturday in Sabika. So if folks are in Minnesota and not here, come on up to Sabika at Hello Rose Organic Farm. And I'm sure that Lex and John and I are happy to stick around and continue to chat with folks, but want to give folks a chance to head to your next session.
So, I didn't recognize the name of your country.
Yeah.
So we're in West Africa.
It's West Africa. Okay. And it's close to what other countries?
Liberia, Guinea, Senegal, Ghana.
Ghana, yes. I have a friend I'm going to talk to on Sunday from Ghana. And, so,
beautiful. Let me catch up with this guy. Chair
Yeah.
But Arlene doesn't mind me to go.
I wish I could have said to the people in the room that I'm working with Earth Law Center to acknowledge the rights of the entire Great Lakes ecosystem.
Great.
So I'm doing rights of nature stuff, but I didn't bring it to the room with me.
In some ways, I thought it was somehow, once we get the bigger idea that it's stimulating.
Yeah. Right, and we have legal structures that protect the corporate state, and that's what I wanted to bring up, because in Wisconsin we have the right to farm on, and you want to go after a farm for what they're doing, and you lose, you got to pay all the court costs, and they make it really difficult for the average citizen to do anything about it. I wanted to bring that up now, so I want to bring up every part of these GMO plants are toxic. The tassel, the leaves, the roots, and they blow when they harvest the cornfields, the leaves blow. And guess what? It ends up on my organic farm. So it's like a massive scale. A lot of people don't know that. Even the farmers I talk to, the planting crops don't know that. They don't know every single one of those plants is registered as pesticide. Every single one. It's insane.
It's just like, and the whole philosophy. I mean, it's like, whoa, okay, so we had companies like Bayer. Now think of that. I appreciate Bayer did this horrible thing.
Not get disorganized.
And people, of course, you're going to make it.